Well, this week we find ourselves in Genesis chapter 2. Genesis 2. So, let's open Genesis 2, and this is what we find. Thus the heaven and the earth were finished in all their array. By the seventh day God completed his work which he had done, and he abstained on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because on it he abstained from all his work which God created to make. Notice the three times it states the seventh day. It doesn't say a Sabbath day, it's the seventh day. And I know we can think, well, what difference does it make which day of the week we keep holy and we set aside? Well, the question is not what day you pick and you set aside. The question is, what day did God pick and did he set aside and did he make holy? And then people say, well, I don't understand why it's important. Well, of course you don't. You're not God. God has established the seventh day as his Sabbath. He blessed it. He sanctified it. He made it special, and he never changed it. That is fact. That's history. That's scripture. Now, the choice is, will you enter into it? Will you enter in? There's an invitation, even a commandment, to enter into the Sabbath day, to keep it holy, to agree with God's blessing upon it, to sanctify it along with him. You're not commanded to understand it, but you're invited to come in. If you don't, it's up to you. People ask me, do I have to keep the Sabbath day? And my answer always is, no one even asks me, do I have to do this or do that? Don't ever ask me again. Here's my answer. You don't have to do anything. You have a free will. You can do whatever you want. But God tells us that if we love him, we'll keep his commandments. There's a question, how much do you love him? So, I invite you to learn to cherish the seventh day, to enter into it, to revel in it, in the freedom and in the salvation God has purchased for us through his Son. He has made us new creations. And last week we looked at how the week of creation is a picture of what God does in a person's life. And what's the first thing God invites you to do? Rest. Come unto me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you Shabbat. I'll give you rest. And it's out of that rest that we can go forth to do work. In the world, you work, and then you get a rest. In God's economy, that's backwards. He gives you rest, and out of that rest, you are equipped to go forth and do work. So I invite you, try it. You'll like it. So let's move on for the sake of time right now. I want to ask you if you would, please. I meant to mention this earlier. I don't want to embarrass somebody. Would you hold your questions at the end of the night? This is going to be one of those nights where I barely know what I'm talking about. So if you ask questions, you'll just embarrass me. So we're going to cover some verses here. I'm going to introduce you to something I've been thinking about doing for years. I'm going to finally take the dive tonight and do it. So I'm going to ask you to hold your questions at the end, and you can ask all the questions you want while I just sneak out the back way. Okay. And then verse 5, or verse 4, says, these are the products of the heaven and the earth when they were created on the day that... And here, for the first time, we see God's four-letter name, the unpronounceable name of God. It's spelled Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. It appears here in Genesis chapter 2, verse 4. The very first time. Now what's interesting is that it's in Exodus chapter 6, which takes place thousands of years later, where God at the burning bush tells Moses, by my name Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, I did not make myself known to your fathers. And yet all through Genesis we see Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and all the way through calling God by Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. Again, I spell it because I don't know how to pronounce it. No one knows how to pronounce his ineffable holy name. So how is it that God tells Moses in Exodus 6, I didn't reveal myself to your forefathers by this name? We'll talk about that in a week to come. But this is the first time we find it. So instead of saying Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, God, I'm going to say Adonai Elohim, because the word for God here is Elohim. Adonai Elohim made earth and heaven. Now all the trees of the field were not yet on the earth, and the herb of the field had not yet sprouted. For Adonai Elohim had not sent rain upon the earth, and there was no man. And the word here in Hebrew is la'avod. La'avod, the soil. We usually translate that to serve or to work. A servant was called an eved. Avod is a verb, to work. Yet this word, la'avod, to serve, is used only twice in Genesis, both of serving the soil, working the soil, whatever it means. And almost all the rest of the time in the Torah, starting in Exodus, I believe it's in Exodus, or in Leviticus, it's used of the priesthood, the service of the priest, the priestly service in the tabernacle, la'avod. I think that's not by accident. And I think the principle of priesthood is established here with Adam before it's established with the priest. And we often talk about the father, the husband, as the priest of the home. And we read in the New Testament how we are a kingdom of priests. What is the purpose of a priest? Well, if you go back and study the priest and how they served in the tabernacle, you get tons of information. But that word la'avod, to serve, is found, first of all, back here in reference to Adam in the garden. And we find that a service is to serve the garden and to protect the garden. And we can glean things about Adam to understand, get a better idea of what service is. One of the most important things we touched on last week is that your ministry, your service, awaits your birth. You don't just show up here, then God has to scratch his head, so to speak, and figure, okay, what should I give this guy or this gal to do? It says in Ephesians that we were created for good works in Messiah Yeshua. And then what does it say about him? What's the rest of the verse? Just go there for a moment. Ephesians chapter 3. I'm sorry, chapter 2. Thank you. It says there in verse 10, for we are his workmanship, created in Messiah Yeshua for good works. And then what does it say? Which God prepared beforehand so that we would walk in them. Just as the plants and the trees and the ground was awaiting Adam's creation, there is a ministry that's awaiting you. And the way you find that ministry is God simply puts you there. It says God planted a garden and then put Adam in the garden. Where has God put you? There's your ministry. Akron, Ohio, there's your ministry. You a husband, you a wife, well, that spouse is your ministry. You have children, those children are your ministry. You live in a certain neighborhood, that neighborhood is your ministry. Now, if God puts a special call on your life to move you someplace else, there are two things, a call and an ascending. You must have a call in your life, and then you must have ascending by those under whose authority God has placed you. But where, it's like that old phrase, bloom where you're planted, so where are you planted? Start serving right there. Quit looking for the big thing on the horizon. Do the small thing that comes to hand the next 5 minutes. Those are the things. You're faithful in those little things. God may give you something bigger to do. So, it then says in verse 6, a mist ascended from the earth and watered the whole surface of the soil. And here's the verse we're looking at. Verse 7, and Adonai Elohim formed the man of dust from the ground. What I love about that, and I should have made an overhead, is that word for formed is the word vayetzer. And it's misspelled in the Hebrew Bible. In this place, that word vayetzer is misspelled. It's supposed to be spelled vav yud zadi resh. But here it's spelled vav yud yud zadi resh. Or two yuds. There's an extra yud. Shouldn't be there. But what does the letter yud mean? And what does it depict, Hebrew students? Hand. The word for hand is a yud. And here we see in this word two hands, two yads. It's as if God is saying that with my own two hands, I am forming the man. And we know that the right is the spiritual and the left is the physical. And man is made with a spiritual side and he's made with a physical side. Because look what it says. This is very critical here. He formed the man of the dust, the afar, the dust of the ground, of the Adamah. The ground is Adamah. Adam came from the Adamah, and that's where he gets his name. He forms his body out of the ground. The ground's completely physical, made out of dirt molecules, right? Entirely physical. You can touch it, you can feel it, you can mold it, you can toss it around, you can move it, you can shovel it into a wheelbarrow. It's dirt. It's physical. Then it says, and he blew into his nostrils the nishmat chayim, the neshama of life. The neshama, this is part of God's very soul, his very spirit. It's not physical. It's invisible. You can't touch it, taste it, smell it, feel it, hear it. Completely non-physical. It is nothing, or I should say it's no thing. Because it's something completely away from this world. Something utterly spiritual. And when the spiritual, the neshama of God's very life, was breathed into this form made out of dirt, the physical, when the two came together, man became a nefesh chaya, a living soul. You are a soul. That's what you are. You are not a spirit, though you have one. You are not just a body, though you have one. What you are is the blend of spirit and flesh, spirit and dirt, physical and spiritual, and what you are is a soul. This is so important that we're going to take the rest of the evening to try to understand just this one verse. Actually, we're going to take the rest of the evening to introduce this verse, and next evening we'll talk about the verse. And then the week after, well, next week we'll be gone. I should say 2 weeks. And then the week after that, the subject's going to be everything you want to ask, know about women, but we're afraid to ask Grant. So that's going to be coming the week after. You don't want to miss that. Yeah, pray for me. But so anyways, this is the natural plan we're going to take. Tonight I want to introduce what is the spiritual realm. How can we grasp it? How can we think about it? How can we get our minds outside of just the physical and start to look at things from the spiritual? So this verse we're really going to be commenting on next week. It's one of the most important weeks that you can possibly come. And I really encourage you to come. You might want to bring somebody. I never encourage people to bring visitors. You know, we're not looking for growth here. We just figure growth is a natural byproduct if we're doing things right. But next week is a time you might want to bring somebody because you want somebody to talk about these things with. 2 weeks, sorry, 2 weeks. I'm just testing you. December 6th, there's no service, okay? Just testing you. Watch, I'll be the one to show up and none of you will be here. But 2 weeks we'll be talking about the body, soul, and spirit. And it's one of my favorite studies to do. For some of you, it will be review. For many of you, it will be brand new. And it will just give you a schematic of how to think about yourself and about people. And I really encourage you. It's so important because it's a foundational concept that's throughout Scripture, but I just never hear it taught anywhere. I don't know why. It's so important. So I encourage you to come 2 weeks. Let's start with a verse in... not that one. In Hebrews 11:3. By faith we understand that the worlds, interesting, he uses a plural word there, worlds, were prepared by the word of God so that what is seen, that's the physical, was not made out of things which are visible. Everything in the physical realm emanates from the spiritual realm. Psychiatrists and scientists will want to convince you that the spiritual realm is something that emanates from your imagination, and you're just an animal with an overactive brain, and your brain just makes up the spiritual stuff. That's exactly backwards. The spiritual realm is the foundational. The spiritual realm is the eternal. And from that comes forth the physical. The things which are seen were not made out of things which are visible. Now, what we're going to do this week is we're going to have a bit of a science lesson. And I've taken a risk with this because I'm not a science teacher. I'm a shop teacher. And if I had a table saw up here, I'd feel a lot more comfortable than trying to teach you quantum physics. But we're going to take a dive into this. Most of you in high school, you took science class, you learned the basic, what's called the Bohr model, not because it's boring, but the Niels Bohr is the guy who originally conceived of this model for the atom. And every atom has a nucleus, then lots and lots and lots of empty space around it, and so somewhere out here around the edges is an electron. And the nucleus is made up of a proton and sometimes neutrons and whatnot. And then there might be two or three or a dozen or more electrons in different orbits. Now, we know that an atom doesn't look like this. This is just a way for us to think about atoms. Because here's what you have to think about. You know, if you had a little boy ask you, Mommy, Daddy, what is a tree made out of? And you say, wood. Well, what's wood made out of? Wood cells. So far, so good. Now it gets a little shaky. Well, what are wood cells made of? Well, there's lots of little gubbins in there and water. Well, what's water made of? And you say, well, molecules. And the molecule is two atoms of hydrogen. Here's a hydrogen atom on the overhead. And an atom of oxygen. And you know what the next question is? Well, what are they made of? Well, they're made of these little bits in the middle called nucleus and little tinier bits around the outside called electrons. Well, what are those made of? And what we find is we keep going down and down and down and down. There's nothing solid. The nucleus is not solid. The electron is not solid. They're not even really physical. They're basically bits of energy, little quanta of energy vibrating in a certain way. It's the best we can think of it. But as you get down and down and down, there doesn't seem to be much of anything real. And if it is, it's very minute. In fact, if you were to take a hydrogen atom and somehow you could blow it up to where the nucleus, the size of the head of a pin, okay? The size of the head of a pin. You all know what a straight pin looks like. You can make the nucleus the size of the head of a pin. The electron would be a football field away, about 100 yards, 100 meters. If you could make that nucleus about the size of a golf ball, then the electron would be somewhere way out in Lake Erie. And in between, empty space. You see, most stuff is nothing. Most of our physical matter is nothing. In fact, one author, one scientist says that if you could take away all the empty space and squash matter down to where there's no empty space between the nucleuses and the nuclei, I guess it's plural, nuclei and electrons, to where it was just all the small stuff squashed together, that the whole planet Earth would fit into a wheelbarrow. Another scientist says that's wrong. He says the whole planet Earth would be the size of a golf ball. And I don't want any of you golf enthusiasts reading this kind of mystical truth into that and thinking, okay, I need to play more golf. It's spiritual. It isn't. But the volume of the empty space, and here's the ratio, it's 10 to the 15th power to 1, which is about, if I'm looking at this right, 1,000 million million to 1. In other words, compared to the stuff, the nucleus and electron, you've got 1,000 million million, that much space, nothing. It's just nothing. It's just empty. And we're not even sure if these bits are really even solid. And then what are the bits made out of? Well, this is what's really amazing, is that they say that these bits, the proton, neutron, the electron, are made out of smaller bits. They've identified 150 smaller bits. Quarks and muons and all these leptons, they have all these really crazy names. And they theorize more than 100 other ones. This is why they're trying to build these big atom smashers, these particle accelerators, because they have to make bigger and bigger, more powerful ones to discover smaller and smaller and smaller bits, trying to figure out what is this world made of. And every time they find a smaller bit, they find it's made of smaller bits. And they're basically not even bits, they're just energy. And they have found that whether it's matter or light, energy or time, even time itself, is reduced down to little packets, little tiny bits. And they're trying to figure out how small you can go. Even light itself comes in discrete little quantities called photons. And light cannot come in anything smaller than one photon. It's really incredible. And they don't even know what the photon is, really. But they can control them. They can shoot them out of these guns one at a time very quickly. But now we're getting into some really crazy stuff when we talk about that. And now, here's what's really crazy. As you get down to these small levels, below the size of an atom, all the rules of common sense, all the rules of Newtonian physics all go out the window. It doesn't apply. You see, physics has always been like the most solid and most disciplined of the sciences. With physics, we can send someone to the moon, we can send a robot to Mars and make it land and hit the surface at just the right speed, and we can control it with radio waves, we can make the material so it can endure the extreme cold, and we can make it send back images. We can do all these things with physics. And we can, you know, when I took physics in high school and college, I really enjoyed it for some strange reason. I guess my geekdom is really showing, but I really enjoyed physics because it made sense of the world. And we would have problems in our physics books we'd have to solve. That if somebody threw a football that weighed a certain amount and he threw it at a certain speed at a certain angle on a level playing field, we could then predict how long it would take to hit the ground, how fast it would be going when it hit the ground, and the highest point it would reach before it turned and started coming down. I remember one of the problems, I couldn't quite figure it out, but some of my buddies did. If you had a chain on a table, and each link in this chain weighed so much, and the chain had so many links, and the table was so tall, and you had one link hanging off the edge, and finally had half the chain hanging off, how long would it take for the whole chain to come down? And how fast would the last link be going when it hit the ground? Because it's going to speed up as it comes down. And it is really crazy. But this is what physics does. It's very disciplined. It's mathematics applied to matter. Until you get down to the size of an atom. You can throw all of it away. Let me give you some quotes by some scientists. Niels Bohr, the guy who gave us the model for the atom, he died in 1962, and he said, "Anyone who is not shocked by quantum theory has not understood it." He says that all the rules about what takes place at the level below the size of atoms, says it's shocking. It does not make any sense. Dr. Stuart Hameroff wrote, "There seem to be two sets of laws that govern the universe. In our everyday classical world, things are described by Newton's laws of motion. However, when we get down to a small scale, to the level of atoms, a different set of laws takes over. These are the quantum laws." Richard Feynman, who was a genius, absolute genius, they made a movie about his life, and just incredible, very entertaining guy, just a wit, a real sense of humor. And he was very good at writing books about physics and making them understandable for the layman. So he's a very popular personality as well as being a great physicist. And he wrote, "I think I can safely say that no one understands quantum mechanics. Quantum physics, quantum theory, quantum mechanics, all the same thing." He says, I don't think anybody can understand it. We can make it work for us. We can test it. We can see the results and repeat those experiments in the lab. We don't understand it. Now, you're maybe wondering, and by the way, this guy won the 1965 Nobel Prize for the development of quantum electrodynamics. And he says, I don't understand it. Let me give you some examples of what takes place on the subatomic level. Now, I'm not making this stuff up. These are tested factual experiments that have been repeated in universities and labs around the world. This is not even arguable as being true. This is true, what I'm about to tell you. Let me list some of these things that take place in the subatomic world. A single particle may be in two or more places at the same time. But you try doing that on this level. You try being in two places at the same time. It doesn't work. It's impossible until you get down to the science. And one particle can be in more than one place at exactly the same moment. In fact, a recent experiment revealed that one particle could be in up to 3,000 places simultaneously. It's not moving to these 3,000 places very quickly. It's there in all 3,000 locations at the same exact moment in time. Doesn't make sense. Though Einstein theorized that nothing can travel faster than light, subatomic particles can communicate instantaneously over any expanse of space. Example, two photons traveling at the speed of light in opposite directions. What is that, 176,000 miles per second? Two photons, opposite direction. The measurement of one affects the other instantaneously. The particles seem to be aware of what happens to each of the others. In fact, they are now positive that every particle in the universe is somehow connected to every other particle. In other words, you don't do anything by yourself. Everything you do, everything that happens affects everything else in the universe. Everything has eternal consequences, is what they're saying. Here's another one. In quantum physics, the observer influences the object observed. You see, I mean, Ken, sit just in close, I'll use it as an example. If Ken is over there counting the change in his pocket, and I'm not looking, it doesn't affect the amount of change in his pocket or his accounting of it. And if I watch him count his change, it doesn't change anything. In the quantum world, it does. If I'm watching something, if I'm observing something, measuring something with an instrument, it affects what is being measured. In other words, the observer is completely involved and influencing the thing observed. Now, that's amazing. That means we are intimately, inextricably united and connected with the world, with the universe. It's interesting that the ancient rabbis from thousands of years ago said that beyond these dimensions of, you know, height and width and depth and time, that there's another dimension called soul. And that what they say is that we as living souls influence everything we look at, everything we see around us, and just by being here, we affect everything around us. Isn't that interesting? And the physicists are just catching up with that. An atom is mostly empty space, like we saw in the Bohr model. But even, now you ready for this? Even this empty space, the empty space, is filled with energy. There is more energy in 1 cubic centimeter, that's about the size of a sugar cube. There's more energy in 1 cubic centimeter of empty space than in all the matter of the known universe. There's no energy shortage. We just don't know how to get it out. Even the solid parts of an atom are not solid, but can behave as both particles and as pure energy waves. In one moment they seem to be solid, but when we go to measure as a wave, it becomes a wave. It's like what we look for is what we get. If we look for one thing, that's what we get. We look for this, we get that. We can't measure both things at the same time. Oh, and this one gets real weird. Some particles can travel backward in time as well as forward. The idea of something being local or existing in one place is incorrect. Everything is non-local. The particles are intimately linked on some level that is beyond time and space. Time and space, the most basic features of the world in which we live, are somehow superseded in the quantum world by the notion of everything touching all the time. And then this one is kind of hard to explain. Quantum physics is probabilistic. In other words, it seems like all existence is basically a set of odds, probabilities. Everything is just a probability. And it's all, like, the probabilities exist, but the real matter is just kind of a misty kind of a, what's the word I'm looking for, indicator that this probability came out a certain way. For example, you may think that if you take a kettle made out of metal and you fill it with water and you put it on the stove and turn up the heat to a certain degree that it will boil. Because that's what it's always done before. What you're doing is when you put the kettle out of metal and put water in the kettle that's of metal and you put it on the stove, turn up the gas, turn up the heat, and give it time, you're doing things to increase the probability that water will boil. But that water's not boiling because of what you've done. You just increase probabilities that it will. And it usually does. But according to quantum physics, one day you could put water in that kettle, put on the stove, turn up the heat, and you go back, it's an ice cube. Or became a hedgehog or something. I mean, it's just probability. And which is way beyond me, but this has been proven to be so. Jeffrey Satenover, who is a real character. He's a Jewish physicist, and he's appeared in a lot of documentaries and different things, talk about quantum physics. He's quite a guy. If you ever get a chance to listen to him, he's really neat. He says, reality, he comments on this, says, reality as we experience it is constantly being created freshly at every moment out of the pool of possibilities. But the real mysteriousness in this is that out of that pool of possibilities, which one is the one that is going to happen is determined by nothing that is part of the physical universe. There is no process that makes that happen. Now, physicists are always talking about this, and I'll be real honest with you, I don't quite understand it. But it reminds me of a verse, Proverbs 16:33. The dice are thrown into the lap, but their every decision is from the Lord. It's as if, you know, God created the quantum world. And the quantum world he's created in such a way that we would discover at this particular time in civilization, we would realize it blows all of our scientific theories completely out the window. It does things that we would have said 100 years ago were absolutely totally impossible, and yet now they're provable that they do happen. And we even use these things, as I've discussed, to make microchips work and computers and all kinds of things that we use in everyday applications because of the quantum world. And this whole thing about the probabilities, the pool of probabilities, God designed things that way, but he says, it's not just probability, I'm in control. The dice are thrown, but I control the outcome of it. Chuck Missler, who is a brilliant, he's a believer, he's very very astute when it comes to Hebraic thought and to Hebrew, and he, if you ever get a chance to listen to Chuck or read some of his writings, he really is a great guy. And he's a bit of a scientist himself. And in 1994, he did a two-hour teaching called Beyond Perception, and is available on CD and cassette, and he talks about the quantum world. And it kind of makes your hair stand on end. But he's a very scientific guy, very logical. He's just going through this. And in his talk, he said, physics, the most rigorous of the sciences, is now cast adrift on a sea of uncertainty. If all our common sense notions about the universe were correct, then science would have solved the secrets of the universe thousands of years ago. But higher dimensional geometry may be the ultimate source of unity in our conceptions of the universe. So what's he talking about in that last sentence? He's saying what we have to realize is that we are trapped basically in three dimensions. Four if you count time. But we can move forward and backward, left and right, up and down. Three dimensions. And then you can add a fourth dimension, time. Now what's interesting, in the Zohar, which is a very problematic writing, and some people say it's written 500 years ago, others say it's written 2,000 years ago, but it's studied widely by Orthodox Jews. And what's interesting is the material that's in the Zohar is often quoted by Yeshua, by John, and by Paul. There are many things that they say that are found nowhere in the Jewish writings except there. And one of these days I might even get brave. We'll see how tonight goes over. One of these days I might get brave enough to share with you some of the things, their quotes that come directly from this material that is recorded in the Zohar. But in the Zohar, what's interesting, and I'm not endorsing it that you should go out and buy it and read it. All right, it's not that sort of thing. And but it's really bizarre stuff. But in there it says that at the creation, and the basis on the insights into Genesis chapter 1, that at the creation there were 10 dimensions created. But four of them opened, four of them blossomed out, and we experience only four of them. Just, you know, length and width and height and time. But there are actually 10. Well, guess what the quantum physicists have discovered? There are 10 dimensions, and at the Big Bang, I don't say creation, the Big Bang, four of them unfolded, but six of them still exist, but they exist outside of our realm of experience. But we found particles that leave these four dimensions, and they disappear and go into these others, and then they sometimes pop back in. This is science. It's been experimented and proven in the laboratory over and over and over again around the world. So it's not just theorizing. It's been tested and proven. But it's interesting, again, the physicists are catching up to the rabbis. Now, Chuck Misser says what we need to do to understand this world, we must begin to understand as best we can what these other dimensions are like. And what... this is really the crux of what I want to get to tonight. And what I'm about to share with you comes from two books. One book was written in 1884 by a clergyman. His name was Edwin Abbott. He was the headmaster of the City of London School. And he wrote a novel called Flatland. And in this novel, he writes a story about a civilization that lives in a two-dimensional world. They've got left and right, and they have up and down, but there's no forward and back in this world. They're two-dimensional. They're flat. Okay? So they waddle this way and waddle this way, and they can jump up and down, but they can't come toward you. They can't even see you, because you're outside their dimension of experience. Exactly one century later, in 1984, a Canadian who is a doctor of mathematics and computer science at, I think it's Ontario University, University of Ontario in Canada, after he read Flatland, he was inspired to make an updated version, and he calls that Planiverse. I happened to pick up a copy of the year that it was written. I'd read Flatland, and when Planiverse came out, I was interested and gobbled it up. And I still have it, in fact. There it was right on my shelf. And so I copied some images out of it. And what I like about Planiverse is very heavily illustrated. And so if you wonder what a two-dimensional creature might look like, there you go. Now remember, we're trying to understand as three-dimensional people what it would be like to exist in a two-dimensional world where there's left and right, and there's up and down, but there's no forward and backward. So we'll call this person Mr. Flat. All right? And he has no thickness to him. He's no thicker than the image on that screen right now. He has no concept that you and I even exist. He cannot, he doesn't have the capacity to visualize anything outside of his two dimensions. And so he can kind of waddle to the right. He can waddle to the left. And if he runs into Mrs. Flat and has to pass her, what does he have to do? Yeah, jump up. And in fact, in this novel, they have a system of etiquette set up that if you're going one direction, you get to go over. But if you're going the other direction, you have to lay down so the other person can go over. You see? And so here's I don't know if that's Mr. Flat or Mrs. Flat, but one of them's laying down so the other one can go over and get past them. And he goes on to how they can have homes down inside the ground, and they can have water and boats and so on, talks about their technology. And it's really amazing how this man develops this whole civilization based on the two-dimensional world. And you kind of follow me so far. Now, here's what's interesting. I can look at Mr. Flat here, and I can see all of his internal organs, and he has to have two arms on each side because he can't reach an arm over to help out, so he has to have two on this side and two on this side. And his head kind of goes like this. He can look this way and look that way. He only has one eye, and so he can go either way. But what's that? Oh, no, there's no around. There's this way, that way, and that's it. You can't go forward and backwards. Now, I could look inside Mr. Flat, and I can see all of his internal organs. I know Mr. Flat better than he knows himself. Now, let me ask you a question. If Mr. Flat looks over and he sees Mrs. Flat, what does he see? Oh, yeah, he sees something. He sees a vertical line. It's just a vertical line. All he sees is a vertical line. Now, think about this for a moment. Here we are, three-dimensional creatures. We look up there, we see Mr. and Mrs. Flat in this two-dimensional world. What if I were to go to just grab Mrs. Flat and yank her out? What would Mr. Flat see? She just disappeared. See, I pulled her out of that two-dimensional world into this three. And to him, he just disappeared. Gone. And he does not have the capacity to picture this third dimension that we're all used to operating in. You follow? Think about this. I could take my finger, and I could go up to Mr. Flat and put my finger just right up a millionth of an inch away from him. He doesn't even know I'm there. Because he can't see forward and backward. He just sees left and right and up. You see where I'm going with this? So here we as three-dimensional creatures, we can understand this two-dimensional world so well. And let's say Mrs. Flat walked all the way around to where she's on the opposite side of the world. Mr. Flat can't see Mrs. Flat. She can't see him. But here we stand. We see both of them perfectly clearly. Do you get the idea? Now, let's take and apply all of this to our universe. We live in three dimensions. And let's say God lives in the fourth. So we're in a three-dimensional room. Four walls, a ceiling, and a floor, the doors are locked. We're in the upper room. It's after the resurrection, and suddenly Yeshua just appears. There he is. How did you do that? Well, see, for God to be God, all he has to do is live in one dimension further than what we live in. But according to quantum physicists, there are 10 dimensions. And there's a possibility that there are an infinite number. And just as we could go right up to Mr. Flat without him being aware of it, so we could put Mrs. Flat back in the picture or take her out. To him, she's appearing and disappearing. Here we are in the three dimensions, and God's up there somewhere. He can pop in and out whenever he wants. An angel can pop in or out whenever they want. And he can be that close to us so we don't even know he's there. We just have to take his word for it. He's always with us. Isn't that incredible? Just amazing. Now, just to make this a little more amazing, one of the The big theories in quantum physics today is called string theory. How many of you have heard of string theory? It has nothing to do with strings. Okay. String theory, in a nutshell, is that every particle is connected basically to every other particle. And these strings, these invisible quantum strings, they don't know any other word to use, connect all these things, and they say some strings, and the only way you know to describe it, some strings vibrate in a clockwise direction, some vibrate in a counterclockwise direction. And here's what Brian Greene, he's the author of The Elegant Universe, his great book, written in 1999, he's since come out with a sequel to it. And he takes quantum physics and he makes it about as understandable as it can be, at least for me. And this is what he says. These strings can vibrate self-consistently only in 10 dimensions or 26 dimensions. And what is 26? What is that? It's the number of God's name. We've looked at 26 a number of times over the last few weeks. Isn't that interesting? Now, this is a guy who's not a believer that I know of. And he's not Jewish. He's not a rabbi. He's just a physicist. Heterotic strings, what they're called. Heterotic strings, clockwise vibrations live in a 10-dimensional space. The counterclockwise live in a 26-dimensional space. They are 100 billion billion times smaller than a proton. A particle is not a point at all, but a mode of a vibrating string. Matter is nothing but the harmonies or resonances created by this vibrating string. Thus, the symmetries of the subatomic realm are but remnants of the symmetry of higher dimensional space. In other words, everything we experience in this three-dimensional world is some harmony, some resonance that comes from dimensions beyond ours. You know, it's interesting, as we think about this, we realize in Genesis 1 that the whole world came into existence because of God's voice. And I've shared with you before that in Hebraic thought, They believe that God sang the universe into existence. And they say if God ever stopped to take a breath and quit singing it forth, it would all just collapse. It would just disappear. And they call this the sustaining utterance. As God continues to sing forth creation and hold those notes, we exist. And what string theory is teaching here is this. It's saying, if I tap this overhead projector or this Bible or this stand or my head, I experience something that's solid, rock solid, you know, solid and real. But they say, but it's not. They say, what you experience here as the plastic rim on this projector is really the vibrating interference waves of energy from these strings. They're just think of vibrations. When these vibrations interact with each other, these energies interact and coincide with each other, it manifests as this texture of hard plastic. But it's really just interference waves. You know, when you drop two pebbles into a pond, they send out waves. Where the waves exactly coincide, they will double in height. Or if a trough and a peak hit each other at the same time, they cancel each other out. So you see some waves real tall and those just flat spots. And so they say the same thing happens with these vibrating, resonating strings. Now what's really fascinating is that every time you read in the Psalms about praising God on instruments, it says, praise always, it says, for example, Psalm 33:2. Give thanks to the Lord with the harp. Sing to him to the accompaniment of a 10-stringed instrument. It's always a 10-stringed instrument. And, of course, in string theory, they talk about these 10 dimensions and the 10 that vibrate a certain way of what we experience as matter, as physical matter. You know, if you want to experience quantum physics in a tangible way, I think the best way to do that is take a great piece of orchestral music, put on the headphones, and sit back. I think music comes closer to giving us a feel for what this spiritual world is like than anything else. So what's music? It's just vibrations. All it is. And yet music can make us angry, can make us happy, it can move us to tears. And I say instrumental music, I don't even words involved. Just vibrations at different harmonies and pitches with different tonal qualities. And you allow that to soak in. What powerful stuff music is. Did you ever ask why does he enjoy it so much? Even Helen Keller, who was deaf, she would go to concerts and she'd sit in places where she could put a hand on something and feel the vibrations of the music through her hand, and she'd derive pleasure from that. Music's a powerful thing. It's a spiritual thing. There's even a saying in Judaism that he who sings prays twice. Because you're saying the words of the prayer, but the music is like doubling the prayer. This is why in synagogues the prayer is always chanted, they're always sung. And I hope someday at Bethakun we can sing the prayers more. And as interesting as Rob was leading in prayer this morning, he got up and shared how beautiful it is to be up front and hear all of you singing the Shema or the Ma Tovu. They always say shalom, and it's wonderful to be up here and to hear all the voices directed this way. It's beautiful. It's just awesome. You guys are great. But it's interesting that Rob mentioned that tonight, because these are the thoughts going through my mind. That it's like it's a musical universe that God's continuing to sing forth. And he never stopped to take a breath. The whole thing would just go. Well, let's close with one other verse. I have other things I could share with you, but I think this is probably enough. Our time is gone. But one of my favorite verses has grown to be more and more precious to me. 2 Corinthians 4:18. We are not looking at what can be seen. Are you? Are you looking at what can be seen? Or are you looking at what cannot be seen? Direct your minds and your attention beyond the physical stuff of this world. We are not looking at what can be seen, but at what cannot be seen. For what can be seen is temporary, but what cannot be seen is eternal. You know, this teaching tonight is to introduce us to the fact, as we'll look at next week, in 2 weeks, we won't be here next week, 2 weeks, that you and I are very unique. We're like amphibians. We dwell in the physical world, and yet we also are made of spiritual stuff, the very breath of God. We're the touch point of these two. That's an incredible thing. What an honor it is to be a human being. What an honor it is. And the scriptures tell us that God has crowned man with splendor and glory. Do you ever think of that about yourself? You know, we shouldn't be arrogant for being human, but there's a healthy pride in thinking God has made me in his image. He's given me the ability to reason and to know him. What an honor that he thought I was worth bringing into existence. I'm his idea. He thought me up and thought, doggone it, I'm going to make that person. Now, what are you doing with it? Because being in his image, you have a free will. You can follow, you can rebel, you can do your own thing, or you can seek after his face. But what an honor it is to be a human. To be a son or a daughter of Adam and Eve. What an incredible honor that is. Don't ever lose sight of that. So here we are, spiritual and physical. But the other reason for this teaching is also to get you to realize there's a lot more. I mean, to truly realize there's a lot more than this three-dimensional world. We're all like Mr. and Mrs. Flat up here. We're thinking, this is all there is? We should be asking, is this anything at all? And God's given us the ability to realize there are dimensions beyond this, and the scriptures support this throughout. And if this does nothing more than just to get you to realize this world is not my home, it's just a launching pad. It's just the starting place, because I'm going to go someplace I can't go on my own. And God's going to be bringing me into the world to come, this incredible place. And you know, when you realize you're seated with him in heavenly places, it's a lot easier to walk and live in this world the way we should. But we have to have our heads right. We need to be looking at the things that are not seen. And then we can see the visible world a lot more accurately. We can see it a lot more as it truly is. All right, does that make sense? Did I bore you to death with all the quantum physics stuff? Okay, I hope not. But I won't do it again. So if you were bored, don't worry. We won't ever do this again. Now, we're going to take 3 minutes for any questions or comments you might have. Some of you have been reading on this stuff, too. Yes, Sherry. Yes, it will. We will have a Torah service. Since we're not meeting the first week of December, but the second week, it will be a Torah service, yes.
And the second one, when you talk about music, I don't know if you're aware of this or not, who did, it's online, it's called the Isaiah Project. Some university students from, I think, California, gave each Hebrew letter a musical note.
Okay.
And they play the Bible.
Oh, the Isaiah Project, where they assign musical notes to the Hebrew letters and they go through the scripture. Interesting. Okay. IsaiahProject.com? Is that where we're going? Okay. Great. Try that out tonight.
It's awesome.
Good. Wonderful. All right. Great. Thank you for that lead. For that. Anybody else? Yes, Jim.
One was to observe the same, but the person can't change. The one observing him would pay more attention or less attention at another time. Would that produce more activity or less activity in his game time?
Well, the example I gave about counting change probably wasn't a very good one. But let me give you a more solid one that you can actually put in your pocket. No pun intended. But this is one you can actually use. Rob and I have looked at this a lot as we read the rabbinic writings. And you know, this really is a biblical concept as well. The way you look at another person affects that person. Not a word said. And if you look at a person with anger or you look down your nose at them or whatever, you will never see that person. But if you look at that person and in your mind you're thinking, I love you. I'm commanded to. But you look at a person with eyes of love and God allows you to see into their souls. The more you love them, the more you see into them. And when you love a person, just the fact you're in the room and you have loved that person and you expect the best of them, it will affect the way they behave. You try it with somebody who gets on your nerves. You take somebody who gets on your nerves, you probably don't have to look outside this room to find one, you know? But let's say just something about them just gets under your skin. Change your attitude towards that person. And you'll see that person's attitude begin to change toward you without a word spoken, without physical contact. It really is, really does happen. It really does happen. And it's a very ancient concept, and it's a scriptural concept, really. So the way you view the world, you get to choose what world you live in. And, you know, we really do get to choose. We take awaken each day with, despite what the government might be doing or current events, you welcome each day with joy. There's an opportunity and you're with gratitude to be alive. You're going to have a good day because you're choosing to live in a world that's controlled by God, that's ordained by Him, and has design and purpose to it. If you wake up thinking, oh no, it's Monday, got to go to work, then that's the way your day is going to be. You get to choose the world you live in by the attitude. Now, this isn't power positive thinking nonsense either. I don't put any stock in that. But you get to choose how you, what eyes you look at the world through, and it actually changes the dynamics of your day. One rabbi says, we owe it to others to be happy. You know what it is if you're having a great time and somebody walks in the room and they're all moping or like this? It just like sucks the air out of the room. And it takes the energy out of the room and people, oh, what's wrong? You know, it's just everything depresses. But if a person comes in and has, not faking it, not a plastic smile, but real joy in their heart, it brings energy to the room up. These are spiritual dynamics. You're experiencing the true quantum physics, the spiritual essence of what we're talking about. You know, physicists don't realize it yet, but we do. Quantum mechanics is the spiritual realm, where the impossible is possible. In fact, it's normal. And we don't have to understand it, but we know it works, so we can operate in it. Yeah. And physics is catching up with Scripture. That's what's so amazing. It's starting to catch up and to begin to understand that scientifically a spiritual realm does exist. It really does. Last comment, Dia? Get the last word. Yeah, we do. Yes. Good. Good. I just hope it stretches our minds a bit to realize that there's so much more than meets the eye. In fact, the things that are seen are just temporal. The unseen things are the eternal. All right. Well, let's close in prayer. We've been very patient. Father, thank you so much. For you are the grand designer, the grand architect of the universe. We praise you, Father, as our creator, for how you do things. Lord, thank you that we live in a time where even our scientists are beginning to see a little bit around the corner that there's more to this world than we ever imagined. And it's something we cannot grasp with our finite minds, but Lord, we know it's true. So Lord, I pray you'd help us to live each day more as citizens of the world to come and not make this world our home. We're visiting here, and we're on a mission because you've given us a ministry here. May we accomplish it as your ambassador and then return to you. And may we each hear, well done. So, Father, help us to see things as they are, and not only as they appear. Help us to see in the essence of things. And help us, Lord, to see one another as you see them. And help us to take to heart the commandment to love our neighbor as ourselves. And as we do, may we begin to see our neighbor as you do, and to know them and appreciate them and to see your image in them as well. And we'll give you praise and glory for all of this in the precious name of Yeshua. Amen.